How do you go from being a jobbing magician in England playing weddings and corporate events to having your own show on the Las Vegas Strip and kissing Heidi Klum on national television?
My name's Piff the Magic Dragon. You might have heard of my older brother. Steve.
As his older brother Steve wasn't available, my guest on London Calling this week is Piff the Magic Dragon. But first, let's go to North Carolina and talk to a couple of America's finest radio show hosts. They are a couple as well because they're married. Staring back at me on my computer screen via Skype, it's my friends Jean and Julie, and you've got some questions about the UK. What's your first question?
It's about teeth.
Yes.
Americans are obsessive about our teeth.
Yes.
We send our children to get our teeth straightened out when they're like 8 years old. And then we whiten our teeth and we go to the dentist twice a year. And we're just obsessive about perfection in our teeth. The Brits seem to be opposite. You see a lot of bad teeth. What's the deal with the teeth in the UK?
I don't know. I don't know why we do not look after our teeth how we should. It's just not... I just don't think it's as big a priority as it. I'm with you, by the way.
Is that still true?
If you have ever been to a live radio station event in Britain, the first two rows are what I like to call the dentally challenged. You would think if someone only had three teeth, that they would be the best looked after teeth because there's less work to look after three than a full set.
Yeah.
This is not true. They will have three teeth and they'll be really bad teeth and they go, I listen to you on the radio. Thank you very much. There is just something about it that I don't know.
When they only have three teeth, can you still get something between your teeth?
Yeah, I've got something in my teeth. What is it? It's an entire Subway sandwich. Yeah, I wish I had the definitive answer on why. I don't know. I know in the 70s when the Osmonds came over, I had an uncle who used to turn the brightness down because he could still see their teeth and went, look at that. And maybe that's the same. So we are just as fascinated about how fabulously white your teeth are. But
yeah, I mean, we may be obsessed to a degree that may be a little ridiculous, but we've definitely noticed that the UK seems to be the opposite.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I don't know why. It's just,
okay.
Yeah, I don't know why. Yeah. It could be, here's a theory that I've only just thought of is we have universal healthcare here, a socialized health system that does not extend to dental work.
Okay.
So maybe people just don't want to pay, which is cheap. It could be that.
So you don't get free dental care?
Some people do. If you're pregnant, you do. I don't know why. Seriously. Yeah, a lot of pregnant women go and get all their teeth worked on while they're pregnant. I'm not saying some get pregnant just to get their teeth fixed, but I know that a lot of pregnant women go a lot to the dentist because they can claim it on the National Health Service. Yeah, certain people do, but most people have to pay. I have to pay for dental.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. That I think you just uncovered why that mystery is.
Yeah, we're not used to paying for health care. And they expect it for free. And if it's not free, well, then they're not paying. Yeah.
Okay,
the other thing I've heard is in the UK, the toilet paper is horrible. It's abrasive and it's not soft and pretty. Is that still true?
Do you know what? I've not heard that before. I've not even thought about that. I'm trying to think, is American toilet paper softer? I know. The thing that always confused me about toilet paper is the scented toilet paper.
Yeah, I don't want that.
Well, no. Who smells toilet paper at the time they've used it? And what kind of scent could overpower? I don't know. I suppose I've not given, it's also something I've not given a lot of thought to, but we have what we call soft toilet paper, but maybe it's not soft enough for you. Maybe it's because we have all this ancestry of Romans and Vikings and stuff. Maybe we're just a little bit tougher. I don't know.
Leaves and twigs are fine with you guys.
Yes, I think so. Once again, it maybe with the teeth as well, maybe it just shows you're slightly more advanced than us. You took our concept like Magna Carta and then you took it and made it constitution. I don't know. Maybe you're just, more advanced.
Okay, let's flip it now and talk about something in the UK that's way more awesome than in the US.
Okay.
Tell us about your taxi cabs. You have the most amazing taxis, and ours are horrible.
This is the London taxi cab, which are all black cabs. Some of them are different colors. They're all a particular type of vehicle.
They have lots of space. They're very comfortable.
And the taxi drivers have to do a thing called the knowledge. Did you know this, London taxi drivers?
I did not know this.
London taxi drivers have to study the streets of London. If you visit London, you will see, and I like spotting them, and I say to Julie, oh, there's a guy doing his knowledge. And there'll be a guy on a moped with an A to Z map on a like a an easel in front of the motorbike, and he's driving round and he's looking at the landmarks and following everywhere on the map, because they have to take a test to get their license, where they'll sit in a room and someone will say, you pick up a fare at King's Cross station and he wants to go to Madame Tussauds, which way do you go? And he has to go, oh well, I go right down Euston Road, and then I get as far as, and he has to be able to explain it, and they're given random test questions to do what's called doing the knowledge. They can only get a Hackney carriage license once they've done their knowledge. So I think in London, they're probably good because they're heavily regulated.
It's a high standard there.
Very high standard, yeah.
I would presume that that is a respected profession then.
Yeah, well, it's yeah. And they make a lot of money because, you know, a lot of it's tips, you know.
Well, I could tell you the experience from a customer standpoint, so much better in a London cab than in a New York cab, as an example.
Yeah.
Right.
You know the toilet paper with the scent? They could lay that all over the inside of this cab. And it still would have a problem.
Tell me about you guys. I mean, I've met you. I've lost count of the times I've met you. But we don't meet each other for very long. It's like a day, 2 days here and there at radio conventions in the USA.
That's probably why we're still friends.
That'll be why. Now, I know you as legendary radio broadcasters. I first met you in San Francisco.
Yes.
When you were at
Z95.7 KZQZ.
Right. And I think you just started. This was probably back in 2000, maybe. I don't know.
Over 2000, yeah. Yeah. Just before 9/11, actually.
But right, because we were there for 9/11.
That's right. I got back to Britain and watched the Twin Towers collapse, and I'd stood in Newark Airport and looked at those towers out of the window only days before. Yeah,
it was incredible. Shocking, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I met you there and then bumped into you in Denver and Dallas and New Orleans and Atlanta and wherever these radio conventions, the boot camp, where they were on. And I quickly found out just how well-respected you guys are in the radio business in America. Everybody, you know, I would say, because I didn't know anybody when I started going to conventions, and people would say, who do you know? And I'd go, oh, I know Gene and Julie. And they'd go, oh, Gene and Julie.
We probably owed them money.
<That's right.
laughs> Yeah. So you are very, very well-respected within the radio industry. Well, just tell me the story. How did you get together and where did it all start?
Oh, well, the funny story is I thought Gene was really cute and I wanted to date him. That's how it all got started.
And where was this?
Okay, we were both from Seattle. That's our hometown. And I was working for a company that did traffic reports for a variety of radio stations. And Gene actually had two radio jobs trying to get a full-time job. You know, we're both getting started. And I was doing traffic on both of his stations. And one day he finally said, let's meet in person. So he came to my office. And when I opened the door, I literally felt like, oh my gosh, this is my future. It was the craziest experience I've ever had. Like this big flash of light. I can't even explain it. Like it was definitely everything you want it to be. And so we met and I thought, this is the coolest guy. And we thought, well, what we should do is do mornings together, because we both wanted to do a morning radio show. And so we got together, and there's this guy who his star has shone so brightly. His name's Eric Logan, and he is now the president of the Oprah Winfrey Networks. At the time, he was program director at the radio station where I was doing traffic, and Gene was doing like evenings and weekends. So we went to Eric and we said, Eric, we want to do a show together. And he says, that sounds great. Why don't you do a couple of shifts in the middle of the night? So we did some shifts like midnight till 3. And then we did a Saturday night shift. And we're like, this is fun. I think this could be something. We may have some chemistry. It might work out. And then we kind of realized that we may be making a huge mistake, because do you really want to become a couple and start a business together all at the same time? I mean, this could be a catastrophe. So we literally went to a therapist, and said, is this the dumbest idea in the world, or is this going to be the world's greatest adventure that we could put a book out about? And she met with both of us individually and said, well, here's the deal, guys. You can't just be friends and work together. So you're either going to have to decide that all your eggs are in one basket, or you're just going to have to call the whole thing off. And so we just decided to jump in and become a couple and start a business together and move out of state where we had no friends, no family, no support network, anything, and completely start our lives together. It was ridiculous and probably the best thing I've ever done.
Yeah, I bet it was. The out of state thing, being away from, you know, I met my wife, Julie, in New Zealand, and we were married for 3 years. And then we decided to move to Australia together. And a lot of people think Australia and New Zealand are very close together. It's a 3-hour flight from Auckland to Sydney. And we went to another country together. And that's where we really bonded as a couple. It's important, I think. You know, when people say to me they want advice about marriage, I say elope. You did. You did. That's basically what you did. So then you got a full-time gig. Was it always mornings?
Our first job was afternoons. They called us a morning show in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, we got promoted to mornings. And then that was in Modesto, California, which is a very small town, about an hour and a half east of San Francisco.
Right.
So from there, we went to Albuquerque, Albuquerque to Dallas, Dallas to Los Angeles.
And how long are each of these stops?
They varied a little bit. We signed a 2-year contract or a 1-year contract in Modesto. So we worked there 13 months. We honored our contract.
That's important to Gene, apparently.
Back, we went a whole month long. I call that the frosting on the cake.
Okay.
And then in Albuquerque, we did a 2-year deal. So we stayed there 2 years. And then we moved to Dallas. And that's when things got crazy because our show did really well in Dallas. And we got recruited by a Los Angeles radio station.
Wow.
So we went to our GM and we said, wow, we're LA. And she's like, you know what, guys, you have to go to LA. You have to. So she let us out of our contract and let us go to Los Angeles and do mornings there.
Yeah.
And they sold the station 7 weeks after we got there.
And you don't speak Spanish. Is that what happened?
I've had a lot of tequila. And that's not sustainable. So that was the Bonneville company. So after we after our contract ran out and the legal stuff got figured out in Los Angeles, they sold the station. So once everything got figured out, we moved them with the same company up to San Francisco. And that's where we met you.
Yeah.
So we did mornings for them in San Francisco. And for about a year and a half. And then they decided to blow it up and go rock and roll. So they fired everybody. We said, thanks for that.
Right. And I know that was I'm pretty sure that was a CHR station, but you're kind of an AC kind of act, but on a CHR station at the time. Would that be right? Is that fair?
Well, I would say that because we're married, the industry is comfortable with us in adult contemporary, but we've probably been our most successful in hot AC and CHR.
Okay.
But we've also worked country. So it really depends on the program director. Some people can hear a sound across formats. A lot of people are just comfortable. They're like, oh, they like the idea of a married couple on an adult contemporary station because they think it's easier for them to define or call us a family-ish show.
Yeah.
But I would not say, I mean, Gene and I, we get in trouble from time to time because we like to joke around about life. And just because a woman has a kid doesn't mean she's not interested in other things. You know what I mean? I don't think sex should be taboo. And I think a lot of times on AC, they get very, very nervous about your content.
Yeah.
Because you've got parents driving children to school.
Yeah, of course.
And we're parents, so we're sensitive. But we also know how to talk and joke about stuff without ever having to say anything crude.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So where do we get to now? Now, because then you went to Dallas, wasn't it? Oh, no, it was Atlanta.
We went to Atlanta.
That's right. And I saw you again in Atlanta. Funny. There was a convention in Atlanta. I saw you there again. Here he is again.
Although we were doing afternoons in San Francisco and mornings in Atlanta.
How did that work?
That was fun. That was
that
for
was
Clear
really,
Channel.
Really great for Clear Channel because they had an idea that the morning guy there, Don Blue, who'd been there forever, was going to retire. So they thought, well, let's do this. Let's put you guys on in afternoons, and when Don Blue retires, we'll just slip you into mornings. Sounds like a good plan, right?
Right.
But in the meantime, we need you to go out and relaunch a radio station in Atlanta. So they moved us to Atlanta, where we relaunched a morning show out there. And that was the plan, to stay in Atlanta until Don Blue retired, and then they would move us back to San Francisco.
Yeah.
But Don's so talented. He just kept going and going. I mean, we love him. We never, ever would have wanted to do anything to affect his career. But we were like their backup plan. They were ready to slide us in when Don was ready to retire. Don never retired. Don is one of those broadcasters you just love to death. He's just so talented. And I never would have ever wanted to do anything to impact his career by any means. But Don never retired. And then what did we get? A market management change or something crazy was going on in our cluster.
There was a lot of change going on in our cluster. And I know it's shocking in radio. There's turnover in management. That's surprising.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was just weird because in the middle of all this turnover, they were firing. They fired our market manager and rearranged our VP, our area VP. But a lot of the people that we really liked. And then we got a phone call from the station we used to compete against in Dallas, KVIL. And they said, hey, we want you guys to come back to Dallas and we're going to relaunch KVIL. And we're like, you know what? No, we just bought a house. We got a 4-month-old baby. We really like the managers here. We're not interested. And then he said, well, would you at least have lunch if we flew to town? We're like, I guess so. If you ever flew to town, great. We'll be there tomorrow. And then the next day we had lunch with them. And the guy basically talked us into going to work for him. Great salesman. His name is David Henry. And he's probably the best salesperson I've ever met in my life. He totally sold us at lunch. I mean, we were ready to sign the contract before the dessert.
And things worked out quite well in Dallas.
Yeah, about a 9-year run, KVIL, or the first show to go back to number one.
In mornings.
In what, 13 years?
Yeah, the first morning show in 13 years to take it back to number one after Ron Chapman, who's a legendary, iconic broadcaster.
And from what I understand about Dallas, some pretty heavyweight competition as well. I mean, you've got the likes. At the time, you had Kid Craddock in Dallas. Yeah.
That show's still number one in mornings.
They're doing great.
Craddock's been dead for, what, 3 years now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hard to believe, right?
Yeah. So what happened then?
After Dallas?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. We had 7 managers. How many managers did we have?
Oh, my gosh. That was crazy. I mean, we loved Texas and we loved working there. But we had 7 program director changes in – Gene, I want to correct you. It was 8 years we were there, not 9.
Okay, 8 years.
Yeah. So we had 7 program director changes in our 8 years there. So it was just crazy. It was really – I mean, it's just the state of the industry. There's just been so much change. So – in the end, we ended up getting another job in Raleigh, North Carolina at WRAL and came out to – this is where we're living right now. And it's an incredible part of the country. I've never spent time here. We love it here. Our daughter's really happy here. We hit it number one with women and adults. We were outperforming the station. And then we won a Marconi Award. So it was a really good run for us here in North Carolina.
And that is the top award in U.S. radio, isn't it, the Marconi? They don't come any bigger.
Not even sure where we keep it. Doesn't matter.
Gene's holding it in his hand right now.
It's a beautiful thing.
Where it was, I would really have to think about that.
He's showing Graham through Skype. Graham can see it on a video screen.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I guess it is. I'm sorry. I didn't realize it was right here.
You were doing really well there, and you were even gracious enough to have me on the air there and at KVIL. And it was always fun being on with you guys because you're just such, I don't know, you're pros, but that makes it sound like you're like really, but it's so much fun. You know what I mean? What is it about the Gene and Julie show that manages to combine those things? I mean, you are the ultimate professionals. Like I said, you're so well respected by everybody that you meet at the Morning Show Boot Camp. But when you go on your show, it's just like talking to friends. What's the trick?
I think one of the things in life is if we can all try to always remember what it was like when you were a little kid. When you're a little kid, you just are always seeking joy and you are so inquisitive about the world. You have questions about everything. And I think for Gene and I, we always stay in that part of our brain where we love people. We love being around people, but we're always interviewing people. Even when we're not on the air. I mean, if we're just talking to you, Graham, don't you feel like we're interviewing you? We just have so many questions. And that's why it was fun for us to have you on our radio show, to have someone in the UK who has a great sense of humor share what's going on in the world there. When Brexit happened, it was great to have you on an American show to share kind of it was a big deal, but you could also see the lighter side to it and share it with us. When the Queen turned 90, it's always fun to have someone from another part of the world on your show. So for us, I think one of the biggest things is just, we're just inquisitive. We just want to know how things work, how people think.
Plus, I close my eyes and pretend you're a beetle. So it's
Well, okay. So now, these things don't happen very often, but the world of radio has an amazing opportunity. Jean and Julie are available for work. This only happens sometimes. Nearly nine years go by, and this opportunity does not present itself to the radio industry. Marconi Award-winning, respected by the entire industry, people who bring in big ratings, people who can go to pretty much any market and hit the ground running and turn things around. And an opportunity has presented itself that you are available. What kind of thing are you looking for?
I'm sorry, I missed that. Could you repeat that part again?
did my mom call you? Seriously.
If somebody's listening, this podcast is hosted on talkers.com. Would you guys consider a talk format next?
Absolutely. I'm excited because I think American talk radio is on the cusp of making a change. And I think podcasting is helping it. We're kind of tired. Jean and I never wanted to get into the angry yelling guy model of talk radio. And
I grew up with that guy.
That was his dad. And we were just over it. So we really would prefer to do something that not mindless, because we've always wanted to have a level of intelligence on our show, but we also want to include humor and then just to interview people and look at the world and explore things. And I got so over the yelling dude talk shows. I actually started in talk radio before I even met Jean. I worked in talk radio and I loved it. But I think in American broadcasting, I think we're starting to see a few bold broadcasters, a few brave stations say, hey, you can have other conversations other than who's running for office, what's going on with politics, who do I hate, So we would definitely be interested in working in talk radio.
I think like you, Graham, because you're interested in this medium because you're an entertainer. Like, we're here to radio to entertain and have fun, or to be entertained. And entertainment can be laughter, or it can be a great documentary, or it can be a good story. It can be any number of things. It doesn't have to just be comedy or funny. And some of our best comedians are some of our best dramatic actors as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I hope you have continued success. I can't believe you're actually available to the American radio industry right now. I can't believe this opportunity has come up again, but it's like Halley's Comet, this thing. Yeah. So, if someone wants to find out more about Jean and Julie, they want to find out about your amazing career and the stuff you've got. You're writing blogs, you're doing stuff. Where can we find you?
We have a website, jeanandjulie.com. We're on every possible social media you could look for. So if you're an Insta person, Twitter, Facebook, we're going to be there. Honestly, we're just having fun honing our skills in a variety of different applications, because what's really exciting in media right now is you no longer just are a radio silo. Now you're media personalities like you, Graham. I mean, you're doing all kinds of things. You're spreading your platform into other areas. So we're creating video on, we have a YouTube channel. We're doing blogging, podcasting, all of it. So you can find us primarily at jeanandjulie.com. And that's GeneAndJulie.
Jean and Julie, next time I talk to you, we'll be talking about your next big project, I'm sure. Thanks for being on London Calling.
Oh, thanks, Graham. So good to talk to you.
Let's look at what's been happening in Britain this week. And there's been a twist in the Brexit story. The High Court has ruled that Britain can't leave the EU without getting the approval of both Houses of Parliament. Now, that could cause a constitutional crisis, because most members of Parliament don't want us to leave the European Union. But we had a referendum in June, and 52% of the people who voted said they did want Britain to leave. The British government are going to appeal the High Court decision in the Supreme Court, and if they don't get any joy there, the irony is, they could lodge an appeal at the European Court of Justice, which is the EU's highest court. And they're only allowed to do that because we're members of the EU. Okay, let's meet this week's guest. He's an English magician who dresses up as a dragon and is now a big star in the United States. On Skype from Las Vegas, Nevada, welcome to London Calling with Graham Mack, Piff the Magic Dragon.
Thanks very much. Apparently America loves magic dragons.
How is it going?
It's going great. We do the Flamingo every week. We do it Monday through Wednesday, and then we tour the rest of America on the weekends. We do comedy clubs and theatres, casinos, all over America every single weekend.
That sounds like a grueling schedule. What have you learned from touring America so extensively?
Well, we've learned that it's a big country.
Not only is America a big country, Canada's pretty big too. You upset the people of Edmonton. What happened there?
We did 12 shows in a week there.
Yeah.
And we have the record for the most number of people in that comedy club. But what happened was we did a radio interview in the morning. And so the night before, Mr. Piffles, my magic performing chihuahua, he got ill. And so he couldn't attend this radio show.
Yeah.
I went in my human disguise because my regular dragon skin had been locked in the comedy club the night before.
Mm-hmm.
And the DJ was very angry about that.
Oh.
And he asked me beforehand, he said to me, so what can I ask you about? And I said, well, you know, I've just did America's Got Talent. I opened for Mumford & Sons. I've performed all over the world and da, da, da. You know, gave him some like nice talking points.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, have you seen much of Edmonton? I was like, actually, you know what? We've literally just got here and we haven't had time to do anything other than go to the comedy club, do shows and go to bed. And last night, you know, I had like 4 hours sleep or something. So I was like, you know, and I was working till 3 a.m. last night and we're here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, happy to be here, but I haven't seen anything. So the interview starts and he's like, so tell me about Edmonton. And I was like, I want to hear about anything else. He's like, no, tell me about Edmonton. I was like, oh, well, actually, I've only seen the mall because that's, you know, we're in the big shopping mall. That's all I've seen. He said, okay, well, what's your favorite thing in the mall? And I was like, well, I've got the pirate ship. I don't really know what to tell you right now. It's very early. I'm tired. I have no idea. I'm not prepared for this conversation. It went downhill from there rapidly. And he finished the interview after like 5 minutes. And, you know, he's very polite. He said, oh, thanks, goodbye. And I said, okay, thank you. And then I arrived at the gig later that night and Twitter was full of angry people. You know, he didn't know anything about me other than his 5 minutes. And what happened was when I left the studio, he got back on the microphone and was like, Piff the Magic Dragon, he hates Edmonton. He said to me he hates, didn't want to be here. And then just sort of like was very mean to me without me being there to defend myself. And so he like sort of the stuff. And, you know, it was funny because the club manager was actually with me and so obviously knew it wasn't real. And, you know, just sometimes these DJs, they like to make a bit of controversy. And that was a good example of that. So, and we're actually going back to Edmonton next week. I mean, we just suffocated him with kindness. We like sent him a poster for his daughter who was a big fan. But I don't think we're going to be doing that radio show. So yeah, it wasn't the people of Edmonton, more like a person of Edmonton.
Did he give you that old line about like my daughter's a big fan, which means he's not saying
not on air.
Oh, I see.
Not on air.
Right.
Okay. Beforehand.
Yeah.
And he did say that. He's like my daughter's a big fan, as if that offended him more.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, before we went on, I was like, this is not going to go well.
No.
But yeah, I mean, when it started, I was like, oh god, this is not good. I think he was very upset that his daughter liked the show.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, because before you inhabited the personality of Piff the Magic Dragon, you were John van der Put.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
Southeast London, in this place called Forest Hill, on a rope park around there, which is, it's near Lewisham, I guess.
Yeah. And what did you do when you left school? What was your first gig?
Well, I went to university.
Yeah.
When I was at university, I did magic to earn a living. Because that was just at the time that the grants got cut.
Right.
So I think student loans had just come in. So, you know, I was doing magic to earn a living there, and I thought, well, this is more fun than what I was supposed to be doing. So when I left university, I sort of carried on doing that.
And what kind of magic was that?
Close-up magic.
Right.
It was all close-up magic. And like, you know, there's obviously a part of magic that's show business,
yeah.
But it's not a very big part of magic. A lot of magic is corporate events and weddings and bar mitzvahs and, you know, private parties. And I was terrible at that because I just got this grumpy face, you know, I've just got that sort of like natural grumpy disposition. Even when I'm happy, people are like, what's wrong? I'm like, nothing, I'm happy.
Were you really called the Eeyore of close-up magic?
Yeah, I did a wedding and somebody was very angry. They didn't say that lightly. They were very upset that I was so miserable at their wedding. And I was like, I'm not. And the guy was like, you're like the Eeyore of magic. And stormed away. So, you know, and I would make jokes and people would just take them too seriously. You know, I would like insult somebody or whatever and they would get all offended. It sort of wasn't, you know, I was good at the magic. I was technically good at the magic, but obviously appalling at the people skills required to be a close-up magician. And then I was sort of on the verge of going, okay, well, I'm not really enjoying my life. I would rather do something else. And I went to a party. It was a costume party, a fancy dress party. And I went as a dragon. It was my sister had a dragon outfit under her bed. No one else was in costume. It was just me.
Oh, it was one of those. Had you been set up or was it just an accident? Just people decided not to.
It was just an accident. Right. It's just people didn't go. And then the host of the party, it was her house. So she just changed. And it was just me in a dragon outfit. I was like, what am I doing here? And then a friend of mine came up to me. She said, you know, you could do this in your act. You could be Puff the Magic Dragon. And I was like, wait, I could be Piff the Magic Dragon. You might have heard of my older brother, Steve. So I did that and I tried it out and it killed from the first time.
And Piff the Magic Dragon was born.
Yeah, and I just think, you know, something about my grumpy little face in a dragon outfit. Which, because, you know, before people were like, no, you're just, you know, you're just a bit of an idiot. Whereas now it's like, oh, now you're an idiot in a dragon outfit. This is hilarious.
It's all about the presentation.
Yeah, made me socially acceptable.
And your girlfriend is a stand-up. Where'd you meet her?
We did a show together in Vegas.
Right.
She was on the bill and I offered her a donut and the rest is history.
Is she American or English?
American.
Right. And does she open for you these days?
Yeah, she does, in comedy club, she does 15 minutes at the top of like great stand-up, and then she assists me during the show as well.
So what's her name?
Jade Simone.
Okay, so we should look out for Jade as well. Is it ever a problem if you think she's going too well?
No, never a problem. People love the dog, and I don't say that about me, it's just that people just go crazy for that dog. Neither Jade nor I can compete with Mr. Piffles.
How did he come into the act? You've gone to the party. You've got the mistake of being in fancy dress or costume party, as Americans call it. Yeah.
So now I'm doing the act. Now out there on the road doing the act, and I think, you know what this needs? A gimmick.
Yeah.
You know, I just thought I need something else. So we did the Edinburgh Festival, and the girl who was running the venue in Edinburgh, she had this Chihuahua called Nacho, who was a short hair brown Chihuahua, very sweet dog. My publicist said to me, you should put that dog in your act, it'd be really funny. So we had a couple of jokes with the dog.
Yeah.
And it was so funny that we went out the next day and rescued Mr. Piffles from Dundee. He's originally from Dundee.
Yeah.
And he's been in the act ever since. He was a wreck for about a year because he was a rescue dog.
Yeah.
You know, he'd been beaten up by a 10-year-old for a lot.
Oh.
But, you know, after about a year or so, he really came into his own and been an integral part of the team ever since.
Was there a moment, because it seems to me that you felt like you weren't getting enough respect as a close-up magician.
Yeah.
So you decided you'd wear a dragon outfit and have a tiny dog on the stage to get that.
Right.
Get that,
I mean,
respect.
Yeah. I just wasn't getting the work I wanted.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, I felt like I was like a poor alternative to a canapé.
Right, yeah.
You know, I would be at these parties and there would be somebody going around with a tray of sandwiches. And I would be like, what would you rather do, eat a sandwich or watch 8 years of my loneliness? And people would choose the former. So I was like, this has got to change. So, you know, because close-up magic, you have to perform that at these sort of like private parties.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're doing stand-up, then, you know, you're on stage and all that sort of stuff. It's much more of... I just wanted people to at least come to see a show. They didn't have to come to see me. They just had to come to see at least a show.
Yeah, I always think it's a, you know, a close-up magician. It's a little bit like being a daytime radio DJ. People have tuned in to hear the music and then you come and interrupt them.
Yeah, yeah, right. He is interrupting people for a living, yeah.
So how would you describe the attitude of Piff the Magic Dragon?
I mean, I always just think about it as the least interesting thing about Piff is that he can do magic.
Okay.
Now, as it happens, the magic's good.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's good magic. But, you know, Piff is a magic dragon. He's over that.
Yeah.
So he has to do magic because right. That's what pays his bills.
Yeah.
But for him, it's like much more interesting to see where the catering is.
Yeah.
Or to see if he can chat up Heidi Klum or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, well, you ended up kissing Heidi Klum on America's Got Talent.
I did, right on the lips.
Is she
right
a good kisser?
Yeah. Very good.
Okay.
You know, that whole, I mean, I did the show because Howard Stern was on it.
Right.
You know, he's a cultural icon. You know, I love him as well. So I was like, I'd love to do that show. And when I first walked on, he was rolling his eyes going, oh God, what the hell is this? Yeah. Which is kind of the perfect reaction.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I started doing it, you know, he ended up giving me a standing ovation and loved it. So I love working with those guys.
Did you get to spend much time with the judges, with Howard and the other judges?
No, I sort of kept my distance, really.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they must have a difficult job to do, so.
Yeah.
I was like, well, you know, let them do their job.
America's Got Talent was your big TV break in the States, but in 2011, like the year before that, you appeared on the first season of Penn & Teller's Fool Us. How did you get on that show?
I mean, again, it was the same thing of just like, they were making a show, I auditioned for it, I went and did it. At the time, I didn't really think too much of it. You know, it had gone well, but I didn't fool them. And I thought that was going to be, you know, the whole point of the show. But it turned out that was a bit irrelevant, fooling them or not. And that was a huge boost.
I love the fact that you ate the banana while you were being judged.
Well, it's just, I mean, you talk about that character, but I do think that character is very difficult for that character to take any form of judgment.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't really go well with what I mean, I don't really like taking any, you know, anyone judging me personally. You know, that's bad enough.
Yeah.
So you know, it was just like a way to avoid that without being offensive, you know, and just show that I have no. Because I mean, at the end of the day, Mel B is a lovely person. I sort of really got no interest in what she thinks about my act.
Right.
You know, and that's the difficult thing with going on that show is it's just like, you know, they're very nice, but I mean, Howard Stern, I was interested in what he had to say.
Yeah.
And he always had good points. But I mean, really, I'm not really interested in what Mel B thinks personally about my act.
Yeah.
You know, I might be to hang out and have a chat with her, but really that's it. You know, so you know, without getting, you know, obviously I can't be on TV with that attitude, so it's much better to sidestep it.
Yeah. The following year after you've been on Fool Us, your act was actually plagiarized by a Ukrainian magician.
Yeah, this Russian guy called, I think, yeah, you're right, Ukrainian. It was, the TV show was shown in Russia.
Yeah.
It was actually a Russian show, but the guy was Ukrainian, a guy called Andrei. He was, yeah, I mean, he just came out of nowhere, really.
Was he any good?
Well, I mean, he did my act.
But did he do it as well as you do it?
Well, not really, sort of missed the point on a few things.
Yeah.
You know, he had a guinea pig instead of a chihuahua.
I must have had a budget restriction or something. That's the difference between the East and West, I suppose.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's nothing really funny about a guinea pig. You know, but there's definitely something funny about a chihuahua.
Yeah. Well, then you went on tour in 2012 with Mumford & Sons.
Yeah.
Was that difficult, doing a magic act to a crowd? Because you said, you know, it's easier to play to a crowd who's come to see magic. That crowd had come to see, well, they come to see a band. Was that difficult?
It was ridiculously difficult. Yeah, and some nights it was incredibly successful. And other nights, it was a disaster. I mean, what happened was we did a gig together in Radio City.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought it was a really funny idea. So they were like, come on tour with us. And we did that. And then we went on, we did one date for them. And they thought it was so funny that we should go on the road. And we should do this regularly.
Yeah.
So we went on the road. We did these theaters. It went great. And then they were like, this has gone so well. You should come and do the arenas with us.
Right.
And so I was on stage in front of 20,000 people. The first night we did it in Newcastle in the UK, which is, you know, slightly rough town.
Yeah.
And I was on the B stage, sort of the smaller stage, and nobody could see the act.
So you're trying to do card tricks in an arena?
Yeah, essentially. And they didn't use the cameras. It was just a disaster. Anyway, by the time everyone works out where this annoying voice is coming from, and sort of 20,000 people finally work out that there's this annoying lizard on this center stage fiddling about with playing cards, at that moment was the moment in my act where I pretend to break my dog's leg. And obviously, I don't really break his leg. That would be expensive. Need a new chihuahua every four shows. So I break his leg. 20,000 people in unison start booing me, incredibly upset. So, you know, I just finished the act. I was like, hey, gentlemen, Mumford & Sons. And then in the middle of the Mumford & Sons show, I would go on stage and I would do like a cameo appearance and we'd do a sing-along. And they'd always go, ladies and gentlemen, you know, did you like Piff the Magic Dragon? And the crowd would go, yeah, we love Piff the Magic Dragon. And on this night, which is the first night of the arena tour, they said, ladies and gentlemen, did you enjoy Piff the Magic Dragon? And as one, the audience were like, boo, we hate the dragon. And I went out to 20,000 people just screaming obscenities at me. So, you know, it was ups and downs.
Was it that experience in the UK with the UK audience that helped make the decision for you to move to Las Vegas in 2014?
No, because, you know, like 3 days later, we're playing Birmingham, 20,000 people, or Manchester as well.
Yeah.
They were great gigs. You know, we just sorted out the technical elements and suddenly everyone loved it. No, I mean, I think the main thing, I mean, I got offered a show in Las Vegas.
Was that on the back of Fool Us, was it?
It was just on the back of us touring, really.
Right.
And the work we were doing, and I got offered a show in Vegas. So I thought, you know, I feel like I've toured the UK a lot, and I'm not sure that there's much more we can do here. You know, America's a new market, and let's see how that goes. And then I enjoyed it so much being out in America that I thought, well, actually, I'd like to stay here and really try and develop this. So I went on America's Got Talent.
And that changed everything, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that was huge, yeah. You know, it's like 10 or 12 million people every single week. And that show lasts for 3 months. And because, you know, there's a visual aspect to the act, which obviously plays well on television. So they kept playing the clips over and over again.
How's it different to Britain's Got Talent?
I don't know. I mean, it's different into when Howard was on it. It definitely had that credibility.
Yeah.
You know, they're also a bit more positive as a nation. So Britain's Got Talent feels like it's sort of this slightly desperate thing, whereas America's Got Talent is much more positive. You know, this guy's hilarious and we're going to celebrate this and not get it to a point where it fails.
But you didn't win. Was that the plan?
Yeah, that was the plan. The plan was to go on the show and lose.
Why was that? Why didn't you want to win? Because it was $1 million prize, wasn't it?
Well, two reasons. First of all, and one of them was definitely unfounded. First of all, there was the worry that I would go on the show and they would own my act.
Okay, NBC would take control.
Yeah, well, you know, like that's always like the big performer fear is that somebody's going to come along and sign you up and that's it. And like I said, that was unfounded. They were lovely. They were great to work with and we had a really nice time.
Right.
That was the reason that I thought, well, let's, you know, because if I win the show, which I didn't actually think was a possibility at all at the beginning, I just thought, you know, if I win the show, then they're going to own me and I'm going to be working for them and have no more say. So that was completely unfounded. That I didn't have to worry about that. And then the thing that was true, actually, was that I just didn't think there's anything funny about winning. You know, I thought that character, you can't really have him winning.
So how did you make sure you didn't win?
Shot a dog out of a cannon.
Right. This is the lesson you learned when this is the Mumford & Son experience coming back then, isn't it? You think you hurt the dog and that's the end of it.
Well, yeah. I mean, like we did this thing in the quarterfinals where we did this trick with four boxes and we had Mr. Bill was in one of the boxes. And, you know, we said Howie Mandel was going to choose three of the boxes and we'll destroy them. And then, you know, we opened the last box up and Mr. Bill was safe and sound. And so we did this and Mr. Bill was all fine. But actually what we did was we made the trick really good. So the trick looked amazing.
Yeah.
Now, if you know anything about magic, the worst thing you could ever do is put a dog in a box and rely on any sort of luck, you know?
Yes.
Anything that can go wrong in magic will go wrong in magic. The safest way is to have that dog nowhere near the box.
Yeah.
So there was, it was like 0% chance of this going wrong. So we did it all and Mr. Bill was safe and sound. People got very angry. Heidi Klum stormed up to me after the show. She was like, why would you put that dog in a box? I was like, Heidi, it's a magic trick. It's not in a box. I'm not going to trust the life of my chihuahua to Howie Mandel on a 1 in 4 chance on national television.
Yeah.
And so she was like, oh, I didn't realize that. So once we saw that, okay, people weren't really, you know, their magic was sort of going a bit over people's heads. Then we thought, all right, well, we'll get to the final and shoot a dog out of a cannon and that will put pay to that. And as it happened, there were a couple of little technical things. So it's a 12 camera shoot, America's Got Talent, and it's live.
Right.
And for magic, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, magic that relies on angles.
Yeah.
You know, we had a couple of things anyway, which went wrong. So I didn't think that was the issue. So we did that, went down in flames. obviously, the money would have been nice.
Yes.
But we decided, I thought it would be better to play the long game. And so we came out of it, the loser of America's Got Talent. Everyone got very angry and that we lost.
You mean the American public?
Oh my God. Yeah. We got these people just outraged. People still to this day.
Wow.
They are personally affronted that we lost that show. You know, and it's kind of perfect because, you know, you get a certain kind of loyalty that I don't think we would have got if we'd have won.
Have you spoken to the winner since to compare how things worked out after America's Got Talent?
Yeah, I mean, I've known Paul for years.
Right.
So, and he was in Vegas. You know, he did a show. It did like 3 months here, and then it's closed. He's gone back to England. So, I mean, I don't know.
And you've done a year at the Flamingo and toured America and Canada.
We've done a year at the Flamingo and toured America and Canada, yeah.
Do you think you could have made it in America without America's Got Talent?
I mean, who knows? But it certainly was a very good first step.
Yeah. I know Penn and Teller. How important have they been to your success?
They've been great. They've been hugely supportive. And they've sort of mentored me out here in Las Vegas. I work for them as well. I was out of work for about a year. So I work for them doing consultancy stuff, which is me just coming up with bad ideas. Somebody has to, in the creative process, somebody has to come up with terrible ideas, and I was the guy.
What? So you can build on those ideas and make them better?
Well, also so that, you know, somebody is saying everything. You know, you have to have somebody going through all the options.
Yeah.
And it can, you know, it's not the most pleasant thing to be going, what about this? No. What about this? No. What about this? No. But somebody has to do it, and, you know, I think Penn and Teller would rather that was me.
Yeah. And you were literally out of work before America's Got Talent.
Yeah.
How were you getting by living in Las Vegas?
You know, I did the odd gigs.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had a lot of savings from when I was at the Cosmopolitan.
Right.
So I was just sort of living off those savings. You know, it's basically placing a bet on Americans loving dragons.
Were you surprised at how well the act took off? Because I think it was a Guardian journalist that did an article on you. Was it last week or the week before? And he was saying that basically your act, it looks like very Edinburgh Fringe to Brits. Were you surprised at how the Americans took to it?
No, I mean, here's the thing, is that I remember I did this theatre tour in 2010 called An Evening of Burlesque.
Right.
And we played up and down the country in these anywhere from 500 to 1500 seat theatres.
Yeah.
And, you know, the crowd was very, very English, you know, very sort of like Saturday night.
Yeah.
English audiences.
Light entertainment,
and,
yeah.
And to my surprise, the act crushed.
Wow.
And I was thinking, this is a very, like, niche thing, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then we did Penn and Teller.
Yeah.
On, again, Saturday night, 8 p.m. ITV.
Yeah.
And it exploded. And I was like, okay, there is something about this act that is actually mainstream. So I think it's easy. I think it was easy for people to look at it and go, oh, this is just a niche thing. And certainly that was my first opinion of it.
Yeah.
But I found that that's not the case at all. It's a very mainstream act that people love.
And these days, as a comedy magician, do you prefer the clubs or the theatres?
I always prefer fire hazards. You know, any sort of basement that, like, we're all going to die if this goes wrong. That is the best audience.
Now, you've toured the world as well. Is there anywhere where the humour didn't work then?
Yeah, we went to Hong Kong.
And how did that go?
They didn't get it. They just ran around screaming, oh no, he's back. And this time he's really small.
Oh, really? They just didn't get it at all?
No. I did not get it.
So the attitude, the confrontation, it just didn't translate?
More the language. Literally didn't translate.
Oh, was it? Right, so...
Not a lot of English-speaking audience out there in Hong Kong.
You don't have a vocabulary of Mandarin?
No. I'm poor. My Mandarin is poor.
Right. Piff, where can we see Piff the Magic Dragon, a genuine magic dragon?
Genuine magic dragon. We're in Las Vegas every single week. We're actually doing a bunch of shows for Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
So we're there for almost 6 weeks altogether,
yeah,
from Thanksgiving onwards, all throughout the rest of the year. We're doing Piffmas, Pifftacular at the Flamingo. And then we tour all over the country, all over the US, all over Canada. And dates are on the website, piffthemagicdragon.com.
Piffthemagicdragon.com. Well, continued success. How long do you reckon you can keep this thing going before you have to think of something else as new gimmicks?
Well, Mr. Pivels is 8 years old, so probably got another good 8 years.
Oh, that's sad, kind of looking at the life expectancy of Mr. Pivels.
Hey, I'm nothing but a realist.
Piff the Magic Dragon. On next week's show, it's part two of my chat with Eddie the Eagle. In part one last week, you heard how this builder and plasterer became an Olympic ski jumping legend at the 1988 Olympics in Calgary, even though he came last. When he came back to Britain, he was a superstar. He made a lot of money. And then he lost it all. Within a few years, he was bankrupt. When I spoke to him, he was still broke. He'd gone through a divorce. He didn't even have the money he got from selling the film rights to Eddie the Eagle. He was living in a house with no ceilings and no walls. He'd only just put a bathroom in. He didn't even have a kitchen cooker. He was using a camping stove. The true story of what happened to Eddie the Eagle from Eddie the Eagle himself. Next week on London Calling with Graham Mack. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mack. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website. It's macmedia.co.uk. You can subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back or Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk. You spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next week. Ta-da.